the governor is leading a delegation to Mexico focused on trade and the economy. What's in it for the state and its businesses?
Trade missions like the one Governor Ducey is in are very important because it really shows goodwill. And unfortunately, in the past, Arizona's had a few stains with Mexico.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, why Arizona is still a national leader in foreclosures. Is an increase in DUI arrests leading to a decrease in drunk driving deaths?
And the pressures and the pride of Father's Day.
This is T-ball, mind you, and we come in and it's, guys, we're down four runs. Spencer, guys, we need you all to get a hit so we can come back and win this game. And we're 4 years old and he's keeping score.
Plus, mapping a river and origami that does not involve paper.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Yes, another extremely hot day in the valley, and the excessive heat warning will stay with us at least until Monday, and yet again today, an ozone health watch is in effect. We're going to top out at around 114, and then for this weekend, look for highs of 114 and 112. Currently, relative humidity is at 5%. It's partly cloudy and 111 degrees at KJZZ. Briefly, in traffic, accidents I-17 southbound at Bell Road, and the rest of the accidents have been cleared.
Governor Doug Ducey is in Mexico City on what his office is calling an economy-focused trip. He's had meetings with business and political leaders on his first trip to Mexico as governor. The country is Arizona's biggest trading partner. The governor's office says exports were valued at more than $8.5 billion last year. We have two perspectives on cross-border trade and relationships, starting with Juan Francisco Padres, Tucson's economic development specialist for international trade. Tucson and Phoenix have a trade office in Mexico, which is staffed by the Arizona Commerce Authority. And Juan Francisco, is there a difference between the city's goals and the state's goals there?
I don't think there's a big difference. Ultimately, we want to make our region more competitive. In this global arena, we're not competing Tucson versus Phoenix or Phoenix versus Las Vegas. This is Arizona versus South Korea. This is Arizona versus Texas. It's Arizona versus China. So we're competing on a global scale. So we really need to, and we are doing it in many ways, coming together as a state to really make our region more attractive to manufacturers and businesses.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, that's a very, very important question. We need to facilitate business more than anything. We need to really outline what are our competitive advantages. What is it that we offer in Arizona that makes us unique? And we have to sell that, and we have to convince companies that by coming to Arizona, they can have an easier time doing business and maximize their profit line.
So where do you think Arizona has an advantage over some of the other border states, and what areas do you think Arizona needs to work a little bit more on?
Well, we do have an advantage over California. Regulation, taxes, we have our labor costs are a lot lower here, so that gives us a very easy competitive advantage to illustrate two companies against California. We're connected to the major highways that go east to west, north to south. We have access to California ports. We're between the two largest economies, California and Texas. So those are things that companies look at. What we need to work on, I think we need to come together. The business community needs to come together so we can see who's out there in Arizona and who's offering what services so we can sell that to companies looking to do business here. When I say what's out there, I mean supply chain.
How big of a deal do you think a trip like this can be? I mean, how much impact does that have as opposed to having a full-time permanent office in Mexico?
Well, it's very important to have an office in Mexico. You need, as I say, boots on the ground to go to trade shows, to go to meetings, to meet with delegations in Mexico City. Just being there, you're in the mix. You have your ears there knowing who's doing what and who's planning to move and who's planning to manufacture, et cetera. So it's very important to have somebody there. Trade missions like the one Governor Ducey is in are very important because it really shows goodwill. And unfortunately, in the past, Arizona's had a few stains with Mexico because of SB 1070. So we have a chip on our shoulder there when it comes to Mexico. So we need to really let them know that we are open for business. We really want to embrace them as business partners.
Do you think that we're past all of that? I mean, do you think that relations have repaired from SB 1070 and some of the other stuff that went on between Arizona and Mexico?
You know, it's definitely gotten a lot better. I think efforts like the one Governor Ducey is doing right now and previous trade missions that Mayor Rothschild from Tucson and Mayor Stanton from Phoenix have gone to have preached different message. I think it's definitely tapered down, but it's still there. SB 1070 is still there. And in the business community, I do economic development. That's not necessarily something we talk about. That's very political. But the political guys, the president of Mexico and many politicians still see it as we're definitely willing to talk. We're definitely interested in trading. We're definitely interested in opening up for business, you know, but that doesn't sit well sometimes because it comes up. It still comes up, and unfortunately, it's still there.
Juan Francisco Padres is the Economic Development Specialist for International Trade with the City of Tucson. Juan Francisco, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Arizona's neighboring states also have long-term valued relationships with Mexico. For a broader perspective, we turn to Eric Lee, Executive Director of the North American Research Partnership.
Arizona's relationship with Mexico is improving and still in recovery mode. Commercially, and maybe diplomatically at a state level, this commercial relationship is dominated by the state of Texas, and that largely has to do with geography. The state of Texas has been having a difficult time recently. Governor Abbott has made a number of comments with respect to the importance of border security. This doesn't play well in Mexico. And the effect that has had over time is to shift the center of gravity on the commercial relationship with Mexico to the state of California. Arizona really occupies a niche market in the overall relationship. Historically, the Arizona-Mexico Commission and its sister organization, the state of Sonora, has been a very sturdy diplomatic mechanism for at least the state of Arizona and the state of Sonora to have an extended conversation on trade and other matters.
How fickle can these relationships get? As you mentioned, because I always had the impression that when Rick Perry was governor of Texas that he really liked to milk that relationship. And you mentioned with Governor Abbott now, maybe it's going the other way. Are these things sort of at the whim of who's in office at a particular time?
It has a lot to do with the personality of the governor, absolutely. Mexican political culture as well as business culture is extremely face-to-face and has everything to do with the chemistry between chief executives, absolutely. Rick Perry was perhaps a little bit more skilled at talking about the importance of trade. At the same time, at least appearing to be tough on border security. Governor Abbott came out of the gates very, very strong on border security and really alienated Mexico in that process.
Where do you think we go from here in the sense that, at least from an economic standpoint, if Governor Doug Ducey continues with this sort of commitment to smoothing out certain aspects, at least, of the relationship, what sort of improvements do you think can be seen in the course of a Ducey administration as far as it relates to Mexico?
Mexico's foreign ministry has come out with a press release on Governor Ducey's visit, and a lot of that press release emphasizes issues relating to immigration. I think clearly the tension here is between Arizona's dual messages on Mexico that focus on growing trade, but also topics surrounding immigration. Mexico's position on this is that a good business relationship requires a healthy overall attitude on not only Mexico and its economic future, but Mexicans as well.
Do you see this being a renaissance period, a golden era of relations between Mexico and southwestern states because of the fact that the economy is sort of improving all around, the fact that there is less immigration from Mexico into the U.S., at least of the undocumented kind?
Yes, I do. Particularly as the U.S. responds to economic growth in Asia and particularly in China, we really are going to be focusing more and more on our economic partners next door, which both produce a lot of the goods that we use, but they also buy a lot of the goods that we produce as well. We'll soon be at a point where trade diplomacy will be at a point of diminishing returns with trade diplomacy. We've had a lot of it coming from Arizona from the past, starting in 2010. It's not clear how much more of this is going to be effective in growing our economy. I mean, the numbers will be have the final say for us. Will those export numbers increase, and by how much?
Eric Lee is Executive Director of the North American Research Partnership. Recent numbers from the Governor's Office of Highway Safety show a huge jump in the number of DUI arrests in Arizona from 2008 to 2011, from 10,409 to 31,561, and for 2014 that figure was closer to 29,000. Arizona Department of Transportation figures, meanwhile, show the number of fatal crashes are down 33% from 2007 to 2014. 2007 was the year when state lawmakers, led by former Senator and now Phoenix Councilman Jim Waring, sponsored tough DUI legislation. I asked Waring what motivated him.
It was just something I always felt strongly about. It's such a waste. You're having up to 400 fatalities a year. There have been several tragic incidences, of course, regarding children, but also a police officer that was killed out in Gilbert, a newly married fellow who's on, sadly and ironically, on the DUI task force named Targos. He was killed, and it seems so senseless to me. So we had made a concerted effort prior to this to get some bills through that weren't going to be as strong as what eventually passed. But in 2007, it reached a critical mass.
There was an odd loophole at the time that I recall, if I'm remembering this right, that if you were stopped for drunk driving, you could potentially lose your license. But if you were in a fatal accident, the law was such that you were not going to get penalized, in essence, for it being that extreme and tragic a situation. Was that true?
We did want to target fatalities and injuries to cut down on that number, because those are the tragedies that you read about in the paper or hear about on shows like yours. And it's a life ruiner for people. Imagine if you were your child or husband or father or what have you. And that's what we were trying to cut down, and I think we have some statistics now that show some great success.
Well, indeed, since 2007, we're seeing there's a decrease in crashes from 38%, decrease in fatal crashes down 33%. How much of that do you credit to the bills that you and others in the legislature helped push through?
The bills, clearly, I'm just looking at the statistics from ADOT. In 2007, before the bills passed, you had 396 people killed. It went down almost immediately to 324 in 2008, and by 2014, it's down to 265. Now, we have more people in the state. We have probably more people, more driver miles, but you have 33%, as you suggested, fewer fatalities. The injuries have decreased almost 43%. The proof is in the pudding. You're down, like you said, decrease in crashes, 38%, and decrease in fatal crashes is down 33% as well. So it's pretty consistent across the boards. It's better than I would have expected. I was hoping to get our fatalities with these bills under 300. You know, they've been trending upward, peaked at almost 400 in 2007, and now we're just very happy to see this receding. I was hoping maybe a 15 to 20% drop. I will say the most interesting thing about this process to me was I was in the state Senate for quite some time, and I've been in the city council for a while as well, so I've done my share of bills. And those bills never seemed to generate the public interest that this did among just people I talked to at the gym or at work or wherever. People saying that they were modifying the behavior before the bills even went into effect. I think one thing that helped dramatically get the word out was had lawyers running commercials saying Arizona's changes to DUI laws are now the toughest in the country. Mm. Nothing pleased me more than watching late night ESPN or something and seeing those commercials. We don't want people to be arrested. We certainly don't want people to be killed. We want people to modify their behavior. So we focused on extreme DUIs.
Phoenix City Councilman Jim Waring. Tobin Nelson, associate professor at the University of Minnesota, says DUI laws have been effective, but his research indicates that limiting alcohol consumption itself would be another positive step.
The idea is that reducing consumption is going to reduce the exposure of people who are driving while intoxicated. You know, cutting it off right at the tap, literally, is a very effective approach.
Can you describe some of those restrictions? Are those about when a bar closes, or is there pressure on a bartender to say, okay, you've had enough?
Yeah, some of the laws really are about the availability of alcohol. So probably the most effective laws that we found are taxes on alcohol. So the higher the alcohol taxes, the greater the unit price of alcohol, the less likely people are to consume alcohol, the less likely they are to experience a wide range of alcohol-related social and health consequences. Other laws that are pretty effective the states that have control over their distribution of alcohol, both at the retail and at the wholesale level, as well as restrictions on density of alcohol outlets. So the physical availability of alcohol, how easily one can get it. Making it more difficult to get alcohol seems to be very effective in keeping people from drinking excessively.
Alcohol in many ways is just sort of a part of our general American society. It's not a party without alcohol. I tend to watch a lot of sporting events. Many of the ads tend to be for beer or something like that. So is there a way to balance what sort of is culturally acceptable or almost embraced with the idea that you can have some, but you need to know how to limit yourself too?
Part of the reason that alcohol is socially acceptable and in fact embraced is that the alcohol beverage companies have spent an enormous amount of money to help create the illusion that alcohol does need to be an important part of social events, that it does need to be an integral part of sports. Those things don't naturally go together. They've been created over time by a strong marketing campaign. And as a society, we've come to embrace and believe it.
Tobin Nelson, Associate Professor at the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health at the University of Minnesota. Professor Nelson, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Still to come, Arizona is still one of the nation's foreclosure leaders.
The problem is, and why people are still underwater, is that our high was so high and our low was so low, and we've gained back in nominal dollars about two-thirds of the price.
The current foreclosure numbers are close to normal, but we're still working our way back from 2007. That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. Quickly in Valley traffic, there's an accident on the 60 westbound at Stapley, blocking the right lane. There's an excessive heat warning and an ozone health watch in effect, both for today. Look for sunny skies with a high of 114. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny and hot tomorrow and Sunday with highs of 114 tomorrow, 112 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 5%, sunny and 111 at KJZZ at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. Debuting the all-new 2015 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Arizona was one of the states, along with Nevada and Florida, hit especially hard in the real estate market during the depths of the Great Recession. But signs have indicated a return to normalcy in the housing market over the past few years. So why is Arizona still among the handful of states with a high number of foreclosures? We asked realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com.
There's about 19%, depending on another survey said 16%, of the people with mortgages in Phoenix area or in Arizona are underwater, meaning they calculate what the home is worth and then they know what the mortgage is worth and say the mortgage is worth more than the house is worth, so they're underwater. And Phoenix is still really high because we had such a big, big bubble, and our prices have come back some, but not enough. The worst one is Las Vegas. They're like at 25%. But there's a couple of weird ones in there, like Chicago and Atlanta, which really didn't have a real estate bubble or much of one, but still they're higher than even Phoenix as far as the number of homeowners that are underwater.
Arizona is supposed to have a process that has been more efficient, quicker in terms of moving these foreclosures through. In fact, that was one of the reasons, I suppose, people thought that we were going to recover somewhat faster, even though the dip was so deep. How do we jibe those together, this idea that we're still in that bottom five, and yet we have this process that maybe should have not made that the case?
Well, it wasn't so much that our process was super fast, which it was. It was the fastest of any state when just for somebody to get foreclosed on. So we bounced back a little quicker. But the problem is, and why people are still underwater, is that our high was so high and our low was so low. And we've gained back in nominal dollars about two-thirds of the price. So a ton of people who used to be underwater are not underwater anymore. But there's still, you know, we still have to go another third to get to where the prices were in 2006. And in inflation adjusted, we may never get back to that, but in nominal dollars, it could be another 4 or 8 years before we get back to those prices.
John, do you recall, based on your experience as a realtor and an economist as well, before the boom when things were going crazy and then, of course, before the dip, is there a percentage you can think of that we were at before that seems like kind of a normal foreclosure percentage?
The number is like, I can't remember, 3, 4, 5%. We're back to normal as far as the number of foreclosures going into the system. Okay. We're normal, and we will probably get below normal as far as the number of foreclosures, because when you get prices going up so steeply over a few years, people aren't going to get foreclosed on. They're just going to, let's say they lose their job, they can't make the payment, they'll just sell the house and make money. They're not going to get foreclosed on or have to do a short sale.
So what we're talking about really are those lingering foreclosures. If we look at, if we took it independently in a vacuum, the foreclosure situation right now is about average. It's just that we have the other ones that are still in there in that process.
Yeah, the ones from the olden days at the bot at the top of the market, or there was a lot of people that did cash out refi at the top of the market. That was a killer.
Yeah. So how is that affecting the current market, the current pace of sales?
It has one effect, is that those people, those, let's say 15% of the homes that can't really sell or have chosen not to sell because they would have to pay money to sell and they don't want to do a foreclosure or short sale, it kind of contracts the supply of homes available for sale by maybe 10%. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why prices were so unexpectedly increasing in last May, just last May, is because there's a little bit of tightness in the supply of homes from these people who were underwater.
What numbers are significant to you now that the layperson should know about?
The big thing, the big issue for the future is interest rates. I'd like to joke that I've predicted 5 of the last 0 interest rate increases. But that's, Wall Street is talking about now September as a likely time for the Fed to come out. They were talking about June or July. Now they're talking about September. So someday, I think we'll get an interest rate increase, and that could kind of stop the upward momentum in prices. And hopefully it wouldn't bring prices down, but level them off and get back to a normal, you know, 2, 3, 4% appreciation each year.
Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com.
A group of Northern Arizona residents is trying to get a new federal designation for the land around Walnut Canyon National Monument. They want it to be made into a national conservation area. Flagstaff resident Annette McGivney wrote an article about this effort for the July edition of Arizona Highways magazine. Freelance photographer Tom Bean lives in the area and took the photos accompanying the article. And Annette, how are people trying to make this designation change?
I would say it's more of a citizen-led activity in terms of people that frequently hike in Walnut Canyon wanting it protected. And so it's been a grassroots program in which the citizens have looked at how can we set this land aside to protect it from development, and looking at the different options for preservation and asking the land management agencies and the Arizona congressional delegation to take a look at different types of conservation measures that could be taken to permanently protect Walnut Canyon.
Tom, you live pretty close to Walnut Canyon. Can you describe what it looks like for folks who haven't been there?
I live in a part of the Walnut Canyon drainage that is ponderosa pine forest and kind of with limestone canyons interspersed with the forest and grassy openings between the trees, and there are places where there's steep limestone cliffs. And getting a few miles from the house is very dramatic, deeply cut canyon with sandstone and limestone walls. So it's a diverse area, but not a terribly well-known area.
What's the advantage of having Congress designate this a national conservation area?
Well, I think the main concern of many of us who live here and frequently are out hiking and dog walking and all the other activities that go on, is that somehow the land that they're now able to enjoy could become privatized through some sort of a land swap with the Forest Service and developers. And we would like it to remain public land, and we want to maintain the access that we have.
Is the concern here that some of this land would be turned into housing or office space or retail or some other kind of commercial endeavor?
Well, whatever it might be, it could be a shopping center or, who knows, housing. But that's the real concern, is that what is now public and open to everybody could be privatized and become not accessible. And perhaps the most vulnerable lands are the ones that are closest to the city and along the roadways, because those would be areas close to current infrastructure, but it's also those very acres that provide the easiest and access to those of us that live here and want to just take a hike without having to go very far at all from where we live.
Annette, what have federal agencies been doing to look at this area and consider whether or not a new designation is warranted?
Well, I think the Forest Service is supportive of the citizen effort, and the Forest Service has actually taken great care of the land, in my observation, in terms of thinning it, doing some controlled burns, getting rid of roads that used to be used by people just, you know, having parties on the weekends, and closing down those roads so that the land is in a more pristine condition. So I think they've helped in terms of restoring the land to, you know, something that's very beautiful. But the fact is that what we would like to see happen in terms of a natural conservation area, that it would require an act of Congress.
Is there a sense that members of the state's congressional delegation are interested in doing this in the somewhat near future, and that they can get their colleagues to go along with it?
Yes, I think that there's dialogue happening right now, especially with Senator John McCain's office, who appears to be taking more of a leadership role. There's nothing as tangible as a bill that's taken shape yet. I would say it's in the early stages, but there's definitely dialogue happening with Senator McCain's staff and also Ann Kirkpatrick's office. Citizens of Arizona who, you know, would like to see this happen, like, this is an instance where people can really make a difference in terms of letting their congressional representatives know that they would like this to be a bill that Senator McCain and others could actually take a leadership role on and make happen.
I think if you live in Flagstaff or maybe come and visit, we're kind of naturally visually drawn to the peaks, and it's north of town, and there are dramatic mountains, the highest peaks in Arizona, and then a little beyond that, there's the Grand Canyon and Oak Creek Canyon and all that. So it's easy to overlook what is really a gem right here in Flagstaff, the Walnut Canyon area, the greater Walnut Canyon area. And that is part of what I would like to see, is a recognition that this is a special place, and we should maybe pay more attention to it.
Tom Bean is a freelance photographer who's contributed to Arizona Highways. He also lives within the area included in the Walnut Canyon study area. Annette McGivney wrote the article for the July edition of Arizona Highways about Walnut Canyon. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Hundred years ago, it honored Arizona and was meant to travel in protection of our country. What it ultimately became was a symbol of will and endurance. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor.
Most people know the story of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. It was among the most modern battleships of its time. Did you know the USS Arizona was in service for more than two decades before she was destroyed during the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941?
It had a very active lifespan prior to that time.
Steve Hussman is the director of the University of Arizona Library's Special Collections. The school has an extensive compilation of photos, items, and documented history about the USS Arizona.
Among the many duties this ship performed was service with the British Grand Fleet at the end of World War I, taking President Hoover on a cruise of the Caribbean in 1931, providing aid after the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, and serving as a location for the filming of the movie Here Comes the Navy.
All statements made by me is now given in this record are correct.
I do. Say, Doc, now that I'm in the Navy, how about put me on the Arizona?
That's James Cagney in the 1934 Academy Award-nominated film. Construction of the USS Arizona started in 1914. It was christened in June of 1915. The ship was part of the Pennsylvania class, which included the USS Pennsylvania and the Arizona.
At the time, USS Arizona and her sister ship were among the most powerful in the world when they were launched. They had larger keels, they had more armament, more armor, larger crews, and larger capabilities than battleships previously built.
The USS Arizona mostly served as a training battleship along the U.S. East Coast. She traveled throughout the Caribbean and Central America. She escorted President Herbert Hoover to the Paris Peace Conference, and on her trip back, brought home more than 200 U.S. vets returning from the First World War. The USS Arizona also went to Turkey at the start of the Greco-Turkish War, carrying the Marine detachment that guarded the American consulate. In the late 1920s, the USS Arizona was modernized. Among the add-ons was additional armor to protect its vital areas from torpedoes. Around 1938, it was moved to the Pacific Fleet. The USS Arizona's last training exercise was on December 4, 1941. 3 days later, she and most of the crew were buried forever at Pearl Harbor.
Many of us think about the tragedy of what happened in 1941, but we also remember the significant and tremendous service USS Arizona provided for the United States and for U.S. Navy over a period of many years.
Historians say there was speculation that the USS Arizona was going to originally be named the North Carolina in honor of the then Secretary of the Navy, Joseph S. Daniel. The name was changed to honor the newest state to enter the Union. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, just send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic accidents, I-17 northbound at Northern, that has the HOV lane blocked. 143 northbound at University, a disabled vehicle has the right lane blocked there. On the 60 westbound, the accident at Stapley is no longer blocking anything there. Also an accident I-10 westbound at the 60 and the I-10 westbound at the 202.
That excessive heat warning still has us cooking around the valley today and will for at least the next 3 days or so. We're looking for a high temperature today of 114. And then for tonight, clear skies, not a whole lot of cooling with lows in the mid to upper 80s. This weekend, sunny skies with a high of 114 tomorrow, 112 on Sunday. Currently, it's 111 degrees at KJZZ. You're listening to The Show, a KJZZ original production, blending news from our community with national and international stories.
KJZZ is supported by the Navajo Nation 4th of July PRCA Pro Rodeo, with fireworks, carnival events for kids, and a chance to experience the rich culture and scenery of Navajo land. July 1st to 5th in Window Rock, NavajoNationFair.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. Family members of some of the 9 victims killed in the mass shooting in Charleston say they forgive Dylan Roof. They addressed the 21-year-old while he appeared for his first bond hearing via video hookup. The Justice Department says it is investigating whether the attack should be deemed a hate crime or domestic terrorism. NAACP President Cornell William Brooks says he views it as an act of racial terrorism.
It is morally incomprehensible. It is a flesh and blood obscenity in our midst.
Brooks also says it's time for South Carolina to remove the Confederate flag flying on the grounds of the state capitol. Prosecutors have wrapped up their case against James Holmes, the man accused of killing 12 and wounding 70 others at a suburban Denver movie theater. Over 8 weeks, they made the case that Holmes meticulously planned and carried out the 2012 massacre. He has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. Defense attorneys are expected to begin their case next Thursday. The Iowa Supreme Court is upholding a state law that allows doctors to dispense the abortion pill via telemedicine. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden reports the justices say the state medical board's ban on the practice created an undue burden on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy.
In 2013, the Iowa Board of Medicine said abortions performed with telemedicine were unsafe since a doctor was not physically present during the procedure. During a telemed abortion, a doctor oversees a patient taking the abortion-inducing medicine RU486 through a two-way video conference. Planned Parenthood argued the 2013 rules create an undue burden for women seeking abortion, and the Iowa Supreme Court agrees, so telemed abortions will continue in the state. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden in Des Moines.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 101 points, the Nasdaq lost 15, the S&P gave up 11. This is NPR.
Senior citizens are often referred to as being in their golden years, but it turns out whether that's how it ends up is pretty dependent on whether seniors had relatively golden younger years. Corey Abramson, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Arizona, looks at these kinds of disparities among seniors in his new book, The Endgame: How Inequality Shapes Our Final Years.
Often we want to imagine our retirement or our senior years as something that's idyllic, the idea being that Social Security, Medicare, these various entitlements sort of even out the playing field. But what I show in The Endgame is that while these entitlements are essential to allowing people to respond to the challenges they face in later life, inequality continues until the very end. There are shared challenges, certainly, across the board. That is, people rich, poor, black, white, Latino, do face physical and social challenges as they grow older. But what really struck me is that all these things considered, once they reach old age, once they're able to get Social Security and Medicare, etc., they do it with very different resources that reflect their prior experiences.
What kind of impact does this disparity have on society in general, do you think?
I think it has a number of things. So if you're looking at from a basic equity perspective, the fact that I can expect to live two decades longer than somebody that has less education and hasn't had the same opportunities is fundamentally a problem. It also has implications for society going forward. So the fact that we have an aging population, we have more seniors than any point in American history, creates a sort of, I don't want to say a drain, but it creates an issue in terms of providing social services. So not addressing some of these issues earlier in the life course, in a sense, is sort of punting inequality to the later points.
What do we do about this? I mean, how do we go about making this better?
I think the first thing to recognize is that it's a complex problem. So inequality has been expanding for the past three decades, at least, in terms of wealth and income. And, of course, inequality goes well beyond that. It includes our social networks, our levels of education, things of that nature. And the population is aging, and there's no sign of this really slowing down. But in addressing this, I really think of about four things that we should do. So the first is that talks of cutting Medicare and Social Security, I think, are really problematic. The second thing is to understand and respect that as people grow older and they face these challenges, they have different preferences. And these preferences are the consequence of things they faced earlier in life. The third is that we need to continue to collect better data on these issues. And the fourth, which is something that all of us could do and is relatively simple yet at times elusive, is to treat people with respect.
So of those things that sort of as a society we can do to make this better, it seems like some of them require money and other resources, and some of them just sort of require an attitude change. But I'm wondering if the attitude change might not be harder than coming up with additional resources.
I think that's true. Some of it has to do with how resources are distributed. But the larger point that we have to recognize seniors as a valuable part of our society, that they have lots to contribute, requires a sort of shift in how we look at these issues and even things like the distribution of money and resources. Looking at this as an important area in which we can intervene into inequality requires political will. So I think that that sort of glacial attitudinal shift in many ways is more difficult, and one of the points of writing a book like this is hopefully to open people's eyes about the importance of these issues.
Corey Abramson is an assistant professor at the University of Arizona and the author of the book, The Endgame: How Inequality Shapes Our Final Years. Corey, thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Wearable technology is everywhere. Fitbit is so successful that the company went public this week and is now valued at more than $6 billion. There are all kinds of new electronic devices coming out that are meant to be worn and move with your body and hopefully improve your life. But the devices often have stiff, bulky batteries that can cramp your style. KJZZ's science and innovation correspondent, Andrew Bernier, is here with me to tell us about new research in the field. Andrew?
Hi, Steve. So, yeah, ASU's Ira A. Fulton Schools of Engineering, they're researching batteries that are flexible and stretchable for wearable technology. So, you know, as you mentioned, Fitbit's out, Apple and Samsung have watches. I've seen hats that have lights that, you know, can move around, but oftentimes big bulky batteries can really hinder folks' movement. So researchers are looking into how can we possibly design batteries that can move and adjust in ways that move with the human body without compromising the electrical demand that it gives. Typical wearable technology has borrowed heavily from the idea of origami, or using foldable creases to allow batteries to move. Professor Hengying Sheng has been using the idea of kirigami to inspire his research.
It's all Japanese term. Gami means paper. And ori means fold, and kari means cut. So kirigami is a subset of origami. We use both folding and cutting.
I'm reminded of kind of in school, we would fold and cut pieces of paper to make like snowflakes, and you would unfold and it would bend. And am I in the same category?
Exactly.
Are these batteries able to be cut anywhere, folded anywhere? Is there any limitations to what can and cannot be cut or folded?
Oh, so the battery, in the kirigami battery, the active component cannot be cut. We cut the interconnects. You can consider a traditional kirigami pattern is the holding hands people. Mm-hmm. So each battery pack is like a people,
oh,
a
wow.
person.
Okay.
And the hands like interconnects. We cut at the interconnects, and we have a particular cutting pattern to make it, after you cut, it's stretchable.
So looking at the designs, it looks like you start with the same single folding pattern over time, but then depending on the device, it looks like it needs to be folded and cut in different ways. How do you go through that design process? What are your inspirations?
One pattern we use, we call it a herringbone pattern, like herringbone, zigzag herringbone pattern. And we use the herringbone pattern to make stretchable structure. And 2 years ago, I met an origami artist, and he showed me a very interesting pattern called a mural ori. And this pattern is beautiful. And when I saw this pattern, it's a piece of paper, and by certain folds, it is stretchable. Then I asked myself, can we use this particular origami pattern to develop stretchable electronics without using soft material? Because when people think about stretchable electronics, people always think, okay, you use rubber. It's a rubbery material. But use the paper, by introducing certain folds, it can stretchable. So we develop a stretchable battery using the mural pattern. And after the published paper a year ago, we figured out one limitation of this pattern, which because when you stretch a mural pattern, you change the height. Therefore, this pattern cannot be integrated, for example, in a clothing as a stretchable battery pack, because we don't feel comfortable. Then we figured out a way which is called kirigami. We fold and then we cut.
So I'm thinking about the watch I'm wearing right now. It's a very standard flat metal plate and a leather strap. You're saying that potentially a battery could then go through the strap.
Right.
Not just the small little lithium plate that's inside the actual watch device itself. And that could extend battery life,
exactly.
extend power, and even extend maybe kind of these newer watches, such as what Apple and Samsung have introduced, more technological capacity, demanding more battery power
right.
through introducing. That's fascinating.
Right. That's we are working on this one. It's lots of challenges, you know.
That's exciting. Hsien, thank you so much for coming in. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was KJZZ Science and Innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier speaking with ASU professor Hanxing Jiang.
Tomorrow, volunteers armed with data sheets and GPS will fan out along the Agua Fria River and report back on where it's wet and where it's dry. This is the 8th annual mapping event. Amanda James, manager of the Agua Fria National Monument, tells us what it's all about.
The wet-dry mapping project essentially maps dry and wet portions along approximately 50 miles of rivers and streams. And we do so to document long-term trends of where there is perennial water, which is especially important in streams that have intermittent or interrupted perennial surface flows.
I have to say that when I first saw this, my first thought was, I'm guessing there's a lot more dry than wet to be mapped there. Is that accurate?
Not necessarily. It's surprisingly, there's areas where we have deep pools. And I would guess off the top of my head, there might be, 50 at this time of year, 50% of it is probably dry and 50% is wet.
Is there a significance to doing it at this time of year, at this time?
Yes. So every year we try and do it during the summer solstice, which is statistically the hottest, driest time of the year, and also trying to beat summer monsoons that are pretty variable and can change how your data outlook is.
So what do folks do? I mean, when you go out to do this mapping, how do people do it?
Essentially, we divide all our volunteers up into teams, and they go out with GPS units and a clipboard and data sheets and begin mapping all the wet pools along the stream. And then they also collect other data, such as if they are savvy with plants and plant ID, they can document any invasive species that might occur or any wildlife species that they see as well.
So over the years that you've been doing this, have you picked out any trends or seen anything that's been particularly useful as far as knowing what is wet and what is dry at this time of year?
It definitely gives us an idea of where we have consistent water, which is pretty important when it comes to having a better understanding of wildlife habitat and our riparian areas. Water can be pretty variable, but at the same time, we've been in a long-term drought, so we haven't seen any significant changes yet. What we do hope to see, though, in the future, we're in the process of working on our federal water rights reserve on the monument to be able to use this data to help inform stream flows and also be able to use and correlate with yellowbill cuckoo habitat, which is a newly listed species on the monument, along with Mexican garter snake.
Is this an exercise that is a common one that folks do in different parts of the country, or is this sort of unique to the Agua Fria National Monument?
I believe it's unique to the Sonoran Desert area in Arizona, the San Pedro National Conservation Area and Las Cienegas National Conservation Area are also using the same method to map streams and rivers in their units, their national conservation lands. But as far as I know, we're the only three areas that are using this method.
Amanda James is the manager of the Agua Fria National Monument. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic accidents, I-17 northbound at Northern. That has the HOV lane blocked just a little north of there, but on the south side of I-17. Follow that. An accident at Dunlap. Also I-17 southbound, accident at Bell. On the 10 eastbound, there's an accident blocking the HOV lane at Central. I-10 westbound, an accident at the 202. Elsewhere, I-10 westbound, an accident at the 60. And the 60 westbound on the Stapley Road exit ramp.
Ozone Health Watch still in effect for the Valley for today, and an excessive heat warning also in effect until at least Monday. This weekend, expect sunny skies with a high of 114 on Saturday, 112 on Sunday. And as far as today's concerned, if you planned outdoor activities, you missed your window. It's 111 degrees at 252.
KJZZ is supported by Staples, now offering business loans to provide access to capital for small business entrepreneurs with one application and a personal advisor. More at staples.com/loans. Staples, make more happen.
This week marks the 105th anniversary of Father's Day. It was first celebrated in 1910 in Spokane, Washington. And for baseball-loving dads, few dreams can top the prospect of a son making his way to the big leagues.
That's a scenario playing out for KJZZ's Mark Moran, whose son Spencer was drafted by the Tampa Bay Rays last year. In May, as Spencer was preparing to take the mound for the first time as a pro, Mark traveled to the Rays' extended training camp in Port Charlotte, Florida, with his wife Rochelle and their two daughters Samantha and Kaylee. The Moran family has this story in their own words.
Why are you so uptight?
What would lead you to believe that I'm uptight, Kaylee?
You've been pacing all morning.
I know that there's no reason to or sense in it, but it's probably just a dad thing. I probably think about the fact that he's a pro baseball player more than I should, and I dwell and brood about how's he doing. And I think he's doing pretty well.
How's it going? I'm Spencer Moran. I'm a pitcher in the Tampa Bay Rays organization.
So you started playing baseball?
I was about four, throwing the ball down the hallway in the house, not really knowing too much about the sport or anything like that.
I think your mom taught you to throw.
Yeah, she was the one who stuck the ball in my hand. Looking back on it now, I'm kind of frustrated she didn't put it in my left hand, but... It's okay. It worked out.
I was usually the coach in those early days. Was I a control freak?
You could say that. That'd be an understatement, probably.
Really?
This is T-ball, mind you, and we come in and it's, guys, we're down four runs. Spencer, guys, we need y'all to get a hit so we can come back and win this game. And we're 4 years old and he's keeping score.
Man, we played a lot of baseball.
At the time, I didn't know whether I was going to be a pitcher or a hitter. Obviously, it was just playing the game. It was all the same, but I'd kind of do my own little routine that I'd made up, and I'd get dressed and wait for you to come home and go in the back, maybe hit off the tee or whatever, get ready for the game. I wanted to be just like those guys on TV, and one day I wanted to be out there. I wanted everyone to watch me doing what they do. You know, you taught me to never show my emotions on the field.
Yeah, I probably did most of the emotional stuff coaching, although I think I only ever got run from one game as a coach. Do you remember that game?
I mean, I can remember multiple games where you were run.
Shut up! I got run one time.
I remember you getting thrown out of a game one time. I was pitching in a summer league game. You were yelling at the umpire. You were actually a real mess, to be honest. The umpire turned around, threw you out of the whole complex.
You can say it. I embarrassed you.
Yeah, multiple times. Yeah, there's just that fine line where sometimes the dad pushes too much, and sometimes it's good for the dad to just step back and kind of let their son figure it out on their own. And there was a few times where you did that, too, where you just kind of said, all right, I mean, I know you're going to high school, and you have your coaches there, and I'm just going to kind of step back now. I'm not really going to coach you anymore. I'm just going to kind of back off and let you do your own thing, and that's also important.
The truth of the matter is, probably from the time you were 12, you knew far more about the game than I did. I just faked it.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Here we have the mother of the clan. Well, hello, Rochelle. What are you doing?
I am just cleaning up the kitchen after making one of my son's favorite meals and an apple pie, trying to give him an experience of home. Away from home while we're here. Just enjoying being his mom.
I don't really miss home. I mean, obviously, I like being at home with the family and eating home-cooked meals, but the dream drives me. Home kind of gets pushed to the back of my mind, and I'm always thinking about driving closer to my goal.
You know, I've never even asked you this, but how much did you play the game for me, and how much did you play the game for you?
That's a good question. You know, I always loved the game, and it was something I always wanted to do. Of course, I wanted to make you happy, but at the same time, I love the game, and it's definitely something I did for me, too.
What about now?
Now, I don't care what you think. It's all for me now.
Well, Spencer, you know I'm always there for you, right?
Yeah, you probably worry more about my issues than I do, actually.
I think that's my role. It's hard to watch you go. It's hard for you to be so far away, but I know you are where you need to be. And I'm looking forward to the ride and the rest of it.
Me too. Thanks for always being there for me and giving me everything I needed.
I hope I did. I love you, kid.
Love you too.
That's KJZZ's Mark Moran. This story, In Their Own Words, was produced by Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
My grandmother had a saying about being a parent. She would often remark that the days are long, but the years are short. Naturally, I had no idea what she meant until about 4 years ago when my wife and I had our first child. He was born right around Father's Day. Our daughter was born around the same time last year. That timing, by the way, pretty much ensures my wife will never have to get me another Father's Day present. Ever. Since both of our kids celebrate their birthdays around this time of year, it's become kind of an annual tradition for me to look through old photos and videos, often smiling, sometimes shaking my head, and occasionally even tearing up. I mean, come on, listen to how it went when our son met his brand new baby sister.
This is a really nice baby sister. I really like your baby sister, Mommy.
For a three-year-old to English translation, he said, "This is a really nice baby sister. I really like your baby sister, Mommy." I watch that and look at the pictures of my son and me gazing at the newborn in her bassinet in that hospital room with the same look of wonder on our faces. It's pretty amazing. I can only imagine what was going through his mind at that moment. I'm guessing it was very, very different than what was going through mine. I was thinking about how I was going to care for and protect this baby. His thoughts probably focused more on ice cream. And I'm happy to report that they continue to be best friends.
Nosey, nosey. Let's go nosey.
I try to cherish these moments and store them away in my mind. I'm hoping to be able to draw on those memories in a few years when the two of them are inevitably sniping at each other in the back seat. It's just crazy to think about what changes in kids over the course of a year. Our one-year-old has gone from basically a helpless lump to someone who seems to have favorite foods, cheese and peas if you're curious, who can get around on her own and smiles and laughs at appropriate times. I know I'm biased, but I could listen to this all day. Our four-year-old has gone from kind of understandable to calling me at work to tell me knock-knock jokes. Or how about this? A few weeks ago, on the night before his fourth birthday, for his bedtime story, he picked, "Oh, the places you'll go." I had a little trouble getting through that one. I can't help but wonder what's next. I know there's some amazing stuff to come, but I also know that'll likely replace things I've really come to love. Like how when you tickle my daughter, she buries her head in my shoulder and snuggles in tight. Or how when I ask my son if he's ready to go to sleep or wants me to cuddle with him in his big boy bed, he answers, "Cuddle, please." I know one day he'll kick me out, and I know one day my daughter will ask me to stop tickling her, and I know those will be good things, but it'll still be sad. I'll miss those sounds of laughter and winding down the day. But when that happens, I'll try to keep my son's advice in my head.
Say, "Don't worry about a thing. Cause everywhere thing, it's gonna be all right. Say, don't worry about a thing. Cause everywhere thing, it's gonna be all right. What's morning? Smile on the rising sun. Three little birds on my doorstep,
singing a sweet song, a melody pure and true. Saying, this is my message to you. Sing, don't worry about a thing. Cause every little thing is gonna be alright. Singing, don't worry
And a lot of things to do this weekend, including the Diamondbacks hosting the San Diego Padres tonight at 6:40 and this weekend at 7:10 and 1:10. What about you, Daddy? What's going on this weekend?
Well, you can check out Monty Python's Spam-A-Lot this weekend. That's at Paradise Valley Community College. Also, one of Steve's favorite bands, Salt-N-Pepa, will be performing tonight at Celebrity Theater in Phoenix.
I believe we're hoping to push it and push it real good.
Indeed.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Marshall Tucker Band tonight at Harrah's Auction Casino in Phoenix. That's at 8. And other stuff going on as well. Off the Cuff, sketch comedy at Changing Hands in Tempe tonight at 7.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We are easy to reach. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Coming up next is All Things Considered. We hope you have a great weekend.